But we do encourage video, especially when you are speaking. And then I think folks are familiar with the hand raise function, or certainly, you know, just speak up. We're definitely looking forward to active discussion today, as usual. And with that, I think we can advance to the next slide and ask Commissioner Visnauskas to kick us off.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us today on our ninth panel meeting. We appreciate the endurance here. I'm not sure if this is sometimes feels like a marathon, sometimes feels like a sprint, sometimes feels like a marathon that we're sprinting. So I appreciate that everyone continues to be with us on these meetings. Our agenda today is to go over the stakeholder input and the draft recommendation. So we have about seven members of the Climate Action Council that gave us input during the last meeting. We'll talk a little bit through that. We also have stakeholder comments. We had over 270-ish people at our large public meeting, and we had over 100 comments come in from that. So we have attempted to sort of thematically group those. We will talk through what they are, and then we will jump into the draft recommendations package with the goal of really trying to confirm our alignment, areas that need to be refined, and across all the recommendations. So we'll spend the bulk of the time today doing that, and then have a quick follow-up. So without further ado, let's jump on in.
Hi, everyone. This is Kelly. So I'm going to be going through some of the input that we got from the Climate Action Council members at, I think it was the February 26th CAC meeting, where there were presentations on building electrification, the transportation sector, and then power generation more broadly. But I'm going to cover some of the specific comments related to building electrification. And to put this into a larger context, just keep in mind some of these comments, you know, for our discussion on the recommendations when we get to them. You know, we're hoping to lay a foundation of what we've heard from everyone before we get into our recommendations. So the input that came from the council members tended to follow a lot of what we heard from the public. Looking at cost and phasing of regulations was a big theme in what the council members had to say, keeping equity top of mind as we're thinking about the recommendations and how to engage with communities that have been historically left behind and left out of a lot of improvements. There was a lot of concern that waiting 5 to 10 years for new construction or 10 to 15 years for replacement of appliances in our timeline of, banning gas in construction may not get us to the goals of the CLCPA, the 40% by 2030 and so on. Next slide, please. Some of the other input here from the council members, again, more concern about cost. And there was a particular comment that compared how we're talking about cost to perhaps how the transportation group is talking about cost. And perhaps we can sort of think about it in the same way where they talked about how many electric vehicles we needed to be converting to each year to reach the goals. So when on the building side, when would we reach upfront cost parity? When would we reach operational cost parity? And then how many buildings would need to be electrified each year to meet the goal? And then there was another comment to share the comments from the utility consultation group with the CAC members as well. And I believe we'll go through some of those comments in the following slides here. Next slide, please. So before we step into the actual comments that we've received, I just wanted to give a roundup of all of the input that we've gotten so far. So back in November of 2020, we did three expert roundtables with builders, installers, designers, landlords, owners, and agents, both single-family and multifamily, to get input. We also had our stakeholder or expert survey where we asked people to provide, you know, their, you know, five top line ideas or priorities that for us to consider, where we got about 65 responses from that. And then our large public engagement session in early February, where we heard verbal comments, and then we received written comments through February 18th after that as well. And then we do have some additional listening sessions coming up for our panelists with real estate actors and affordable housing. So that's a bit of a overview of what we heard from the Climate Action Council members, and then our whole universe of input that we've received throughout this process. So I'm going to hand it over to, I think the call is going first to talk about the input that we've received. It could be Kristen though.
So as Kelly mentioned, we received a lot of stakeholder comments after our February session. Our most active engagement was from environmental justice groups and also energy efficiency and heat pump groups. We received 33 comments from environmental groups for environmental justice, 20 from energy efficiency installer / heat pump groups. And then additionally, we also received comments from one architect, one code official, one government entity, 7 housing advocates, 37 private citizens, 1 real estate trade organization, and 2 joint utility groups. So there's been significant attention and support for possible state codes and equipment standards to phase out fossil fuel heating and hot water / appliances, with a clear emphasis on dates, allowing for the market to adjust. There's support for an all-electric code for new construction, support for phasing out the sale and installation of fossil fuel equipment, and also replacement and end of useful life. There was a range of timelines proposed. There was emphasis on the need for consumer education, funding, technical assistance to help meet the new mandates. And then there were also some concerns noted, including disproportionate impacts on low-income customers, cost of violation penalties, and the transition for workers whose skills do not easily transfer to another sector. There was strong and broad support for building electrification and energy efficiency, which was promising. Also, public education and marketing for consumers, contractors, the real estate industry, and more. Strong support for funding and incentives and technical assistance to offset cost premiums in conjunction with regulations, especially for low to moderate income and disadvantaged communities. There was support for workforce development and training with attention to equity and workforce diversity, and also a statewide requirement for benchmarking and disclosure. There were calls for planning and policy for a managed transition from the fossil fuel gas system, and calls to end the 100-foot rule. There was a consideration for enforcement, which we note there's already code enforcement challenges, calls for attention to HFC and refrigerants, the use, management, disposal, and research and development, attention to biofuels and renewable natural gas, with a note that different views were evident in the comments. Also monitoring and mitigating risks for affordable housing, gentrification, disinvestment in disadvantaged communities. And lastly, additional input was wanted from housing and developers. And I'll kind of get into some of these specific comments that we received. We received what we're calling coordinated responses, which was kind of a template response from multiple different people. The first one, we received 71 emails with this comment, which called to fund all mandates and structural racism in the housing market, invest in green jobs, support and prioritize MWBEs, prioritize bottom-up solutions, and open all meetings of the panel to the public. And then our second coordinated email, we received 245 of, and this urged to sunset the fossil fuel combustion in all New York buildings, calling immediately for an end to the 100-foot rule, with January 1st, 2024, no new fossil fuel systems and new construction, 2026, no new fossil fuel water heating systems upon replacement. 2028, no new fossil fuel heating systems upon replacement. And different dates that might apply for affordable housing and safety-related waivers. For our environmental and environmental justice groups and also the clean industry, we had some common themes with an overall support for the draft recommendations that we shared on February 4th. They also called to strengthen the building codes and equipment standards with solidifying dates, consumer education, pilots, technical assistance, and financial support for upgrades and energy audits. A common theme was also statewide benchmarking and strengthen appliance standards as soon as possible. Planning studies and a process for long-term transition away from gas as soon as possible. And lastly, workforce development with a target on MWBEs. Some specific points, equity and affordability, prioritizing resources to DACs and affordable housing. If resource constraints set dates that consider the needs of certain sectors like affordable housing, incorporate housing quality, health, and affordability across all recommendations, and state and municipal housing agencies to require projects to meet efficiency standards and a transition to electrification. And there were also some specific points for financial assistance with a call to update the New York Green Bank investment plan, a tariff-based inclusive financing program, reform the benefit cost analysis framework, and lastly, prioritize early focus on energy efficiency and or packaging efficiency and electrification upgrades. So next, I will turn it to McCall to talk about some of the other comments that we received.
Okay, you should be able to hear me now. Hello, everyone. So I'll start by talking about comments that were received from the real estate industry. So we got a good set of comments on these. Some of the topics that were highlighted were the need for a more tailored approach to retrofits, and really the fact that sort of a one-size-fits-all approach isn't going to work here. It's really important to have a clear date for when the transition is going to be effective so that the market can plan for it and really anticipate those changes. I think market certainty was a big part of this. There's support for statewide benchmarking by recommendation that any initiatives that are adopted by the state dovetail with the local laws from New York City, particularly Local Law 84. A recommendation to prioritize low and moderate income communities that are going to be having trouble affording retrofits, so really like thinking about how to fund retrofits in those areas, and making the incentives significant enough to actually move the market and align with the capital cycle of the buildings. Also tying the fossil fuel mandates to electric grid readiness and really looking at grid and transmission line readiness with respect to resilience and having buildings be able to ride out the effects of climate change. Okay, next slide. Okay, so from the utilities, but they recommend conducting a study of the clean energy transition before setting policies that might constrain installation of natural gas equipment. This was emphasized several times in their comments, and they would like the study to focus on safety, reliability, and affordability elements to understand the impact on low and moderate income customers and those in disadvantaged communities and specifically around like energy needs, conversion costs, and, you know, sort of what that would take. They recommend publication of case studies that can be used as a template for electrification projects. For R&D, they suggest looking for projects that can leverage existing natural gas infrastructure that can be used during the transition as sort of a hybrid approach and can possibly be used for hard to electrify building types or use cases. And the idea is that the infrastructure could also be used to distribute green renewable natural gas or green hydrogen. And they spoke of the need to identify funding for the transition. Just sort of figure out where it will come from. Okay, next slide. City of New York. So we received pretty extensive comments from the city of New York that touched on a variety of topics that were very detailed, and there were a lot of specific recommendations. For the sake of brevity, I'll just sort of go through these quickly, but there's a lot there, and it was quite useful. The city's comments addressed the need for more information on the cost of the recommendations, including the impacts on LMI and disadvantaged community customers. They talked about the need for upgrades to be accessible to LMI customers and better understand the rate impacts that the gas transition is going to have on all customers, particularly around gas depreciation costs. The city encourages packaging of energy efficiency with electrification and more stringent performance-based building codes. They also called for access to energy usage data for use in the benchmarking and setting performance standards. They called for appliance standards and specifically standards around cold climate heat pumps and also had some extensive comments on the importance of educating and training the workforce and really including in that training those in disadvantaged communities and minority and women-owned businesses. And they called for a consideration of a climate action tax credit. So with that, I will turn things over to, I believe, Emily, who's going to be leading the discussion of the recommendations package that's under development.
Great. Thank you, McCall. And confirming everyone can hear me? Great. Now we're going to turn to a discussion of the draft recommendations package under development. So the staff team is working to incorporate the public comments, the stakeholder input we received, feedback that we've received from the Climate Action Council, as well as feedback that we've received from a subset of our panelists here. So I will start with workforce development. If you go to the next slide, please. And for this, it might be helpful to have handy a document that was sent yesterday. This is it was the version 2, a kind of a detailed working draft of these recommendations. So on the slide here, this is the top line recommendation, and each recommendation has a number of kind of subcomponents, and that document that was provided yesterday kind of breaks out those subcomponents. So starting with workforce, this is a recommendation area that feels like it's pretty close. We heard strong support and underscoring for this as a kind of a critical enabling strategy to enable this transformation in our buildings. But we didn't hear much in the way of changes or additions or gaps. But I will speak to some of the components that we heard from this panel and how we are incorporating those that are called out in the companion document provided yesterday. So a major component of workforce has always been a prioritization of training and job placement support for disadvantaged communities and low-income residents. So we received feedback on calling out the potential application of community benefits agreements and community workforce agreements as potential mechanisms and ways to incentivize local hiring, particularly through certain state-funded projects. So that's an element that we'll be reflecting in that component of the strategy. We also heard that there is a need to call out the key partners and stakeholders, including community colleges, workforce one-stops, or the hubs that NYSERDA is working to develop later this year, as well as the role of foundations in helping bring additional resources to the needs of scaling our workforce reach, particularly in this community. We also heard a lot of feedback from the stakeholder input from our Climate Action Council, as well as this panel, that we really need to elevate the importance of supporting minority and women-owned business enterprises and cooperatives. So we're planning to break that out as its own component. Previously, it was part of the disadvantaged communities component, but it really necessitates its own set of activities to support, for example, increasing that segment of the economy's access to workforce training, increased business development support, as well as thinking about how we can incentivize and elevate MWBE participation across a broader array of state-funded investments and projects beyond the statutory requirements that agencies are meeting today. In addition, we also have a component of the workforce strategy that gets at requiring continuing education on building decarbonization as part of licensing. You know, that would be for design professionals, construction professionals, real estate. And that's, I think we've thought about that as really on the technical solutions, on energy efficiency and electrification. But given the discussions the panel has had, embodied carbon should also be included as part of that, as part of that education opportunity. We heard from, I believe it was Bill, we heard about a gap around drillers. And so that is something that we'll be working into the recommendations as well to support the geothermal industry. And Bill also flagged the importance of this group monitoring a bill that that passed the New York Senate, a bill on Energy Efficiency, Equity and Jobs Act. So we'll be monitoring that closely. So those are the main points of feedback and refinement that we are working into the workforce recommendation. But I'll pause there and welcome any extrapolation from the panel members that have submitted those comments, or if there are any other points that our panel wants to put on the table with respect to the workforce recommendation. I'm not seeing any hands. Please unmute yourself and jump in if you want to add something. But, you know, it does feel like this recommendation is shaping up really well, and we're close. So I'm not hearing any significant changes or additional areas for further research or analysis by the staff team. Certainly, if areas occur to you, please reach out to us ASAP so we can, you know, work that into our work plan. But it seems like the workforce recommendation as a whole is shaping up really nicely. So with that, we'll move to consumer education. So like workforce, you know, we heard a strong emphasis on the need for this, how critical this is to really reach all New Yorkers and make them aware of this transition and what this means for them and where they can go to get the resources they need to take the actions that make sense in their own homes and places of work. And so this is, you know, there hasn't been much change to this top line. However, we did call out the need to create strategic partnerships, you know, for example, with trusted community leaders, those leaders that have sort of deep connection and understanding of their constituents' needs and concerns, and also are trusted in their communities. So they're going to be a really important partner in getting the message out. We recognize that this is going to take multiple channels to reach different individuals where they are with the information they need at the right time. So in addition to into that top line edit, we also received some comments from the panel that I'd like to tee up for discussion now. So, one panelist noted that, we need to describe the notion of shared responsibility or pain in this process and address it as a public issue and a problem that needs to be solved by all of us. So it's not just a technology solution, but we all have a stake in making this happen. And that language really matters. So, you know, when we think about COVID, the scientific community created the vaccines, but everyone had to participate and has to participate in the behavioral change for sort of how we hunker down, and then also how we step up and we vaccinate and we do our part to safely reopen the economy. And there's also a reference to a Madison Avenue style public awareness campaign, really elevating the interest, the awareness, and the importance to help drive demand. So that is that is, you know, we've called out the need for a large scale campaign, but I think that that gives us a good example of something to a model to look at in terms of its successes. So I'll pause there. If the, you know, Sadie, it might have been you who provided that input. If there's anything you want to elaborate on.
Sadie, if you're speaking, you're still on mute.
I see you're off mute, Sadie, but we still can't hear you. So I'll go to the next topic, and Sadie, please jump in if you regain audio. So there was a question from the panel about, you know, the cost for this one was, you know, was put at sort of low and medium, and, you know, should the cost really be low given the, you know, given the need to reach the, you know, broad, you know, reach all New Yorkers through the various channels that they will need to be, you know, that can they can most effectively be reached, but also acknowledging the scale of the kind of the counter effort by the fossil fuel industry to sort of maintain their market. So that is a good question in terms of, you know, the level of investment that we'll need to make in this to counter the counter some oppositional messaging.
Emily, I have a quick comment just on that. It's, you know, it's, I guess it's just an extra bit of thought around it. But in addition to what the appropriate level of cost investment is, I would also ask what the appropriate strategy and methodologies for this awareness campaign ultimately are. I think there have been many attempts in the past to raise consumer awareness, sort of through traditional means. Things, you know, like written case studies and you know, certain levels of outreach. But I would ask, you know, for this particular measure, are we talking about a different kind of awareness campaign that's maybe more aligned with some of the marketing strategy we see today in other areas that probably would align better with what the fossil fuel industry would be anticipated to have in response? So I'm talking about social media. I'm talking about reaching people through avenues like YouTube, right? These different and more relevant avenues for awareness, raising awareness and reaching a broader market, as opposed to some of the ways that we've tried to do it in the past.
Yeah. Molly, that's a great point. And that is something that we emphasized in the kind of the components of the recommendation, but I think we need to really bring to the fore that the traditional sort of the traditional PSAs aren't going to work or might work for a small segment of the market. But we do need to lean heavily into social media influencers, and also trusted parties, you know, whether it's elected officials, local community groups, community-based organizations, you know, the groups that have the trust and have the community to reach outside of those, you know, sort of, you know, maybe government-funded and administered PSAs. So it's going to take really a multi-channel, multi-faceted approach beyond just the sort of the traditional messaging of the past. So welcome, you know, if, you know, as you get a chance to digest the draft that was provided yesterday, if there are other ways to highlight or other mechanisms that we're missing, you know, please, we welcome that input.
And Emily, to that end, a case study may also be a good way to highlight what the panel has in mind, because I think, to your point, Emily, we've kind of got the words down in the components, but we know this is, you know, it's not hard to put down the words. It's really hard to pull off effectively. So if there are case studies that people would want to elevate that kind of provide a good show and tell of how this is done and how it's been done elsewhere, that would be fantastic too.
Absolutely.
Just to follow up, and it's kind of a case study. I mean, we have an example of decades of ratepayer-supported advertising coming from utilities and coming through our TV screens from subsidized fossil fuel installer companies that has been pushing gas as a clean and very helpful kind of fuel. And at this point, given the CLCPA, we realize it's a roadblock to meeting our climate goals. And I don't think more than a very, very small part of the public understands that at this point. And it's the obligation of whoever's going to make this program succeed to get that point across to the public, that gas is no longer what you were told it was and is, in fact, at this point, a roadblock to meeting our climate goals.
That's right. Thank you, Bill. So jumping to some other comments that we received from the panel, in terms of cost and general lack of familiarity with heat pumps, you know, we heard that loud and clear in the public input session that, you know, there's a small segment of the population that knows what a heat pump is, many don't, and so there's no familiarity with it. So it's about the partners that we bring on, whether it's community leaders, community-based organizations, the hubs, the clean energy hubs that NYSERDA is going to be supporting, but also other tools that we can put out into the market to help demystify and help customers engage with the technology and think about what it means for them as they're making decisions in their homes. And then there was also a comment about, is there a way to create a stronger link between health and energy efficiency for the general public? So I think we recognize the co-benefits of that in this document, but that really needs to come forward in the messaging to the public. It's not just about, I mean, for some, the message of climate action might resonate, but for others, they're doing it for comfort reasons or for improved indoor air quality. So that is something that we need to consider in how we message, and I think we really need to understand what messages are going to resonate with different groups.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, especially in the residential sector, where people, I think, often are making decisions based on things like comfort, controllability, health and wellness, obviously. And then I think safety, too, could also play a bit of a role in the messaging, especially around heat pumps. You know, technologically speaking, heat pumps aren't the easiest things to explain or understand, right? But, you know, I have a natural gas-fired boiler in my house, and every time I'm in my basement looking at it, I'm, you know, like, oh, my God, there's this huge thing that's, you know, combusting constantly that's in my home. You know, and I have a high level of familiarity as an engineer with that equipment and how it works, and I still find it intimidating, right? So part of the reasoning for me looking to something different isn't just about the energy. It's also about not having this thing in my house that's constantly literally blowing up, right? And that could be part of the messaging, I think, really, for homeowners who probably aren't necessarily going to be making their decisions on energy alone. It could be a small piece, but once we factor in the cost differentials, in the short term, at least, to go from natural gas or whatever it may be over to electric, some of these other non-energy benefits, I think, are going to be more important to explain for buy-in for residential homeowners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. So those are the main comments that we received from the panel. Are there others that... that, you know, panel members want to raise? We appreciate the feedback, and certainly if you have examples of case studies, you know, where this is done well, an organization that's done this really well that can make this more concrete in the recommendations that we advance, we welcome that input. Go ahead, Vanessa.
I just was wondering if we had a couple of hands, but at least one of them disappeared. So I see a hand from Bill first, I see a hand from Bill first, and then I see Daphne's hand is back. I just want to check if either Bill or Daphne have a further comment.
No, I was going to just say I agree with everything that said. And I also want to emphasize the importance of consumer education. We as a market call, you know, heat pumps. But I've had conversations with family members that have already had them installed. They're like, mini splits, stop calling them heat pumps. So just kind of having some kind of market lineation or marketing strategies for consumer education can be very critical in demystifying the technology and making it more of like an everyday thing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Daphne. Bill, did you have another comment?
Sorry, I'm trying to unraise my hand.
Oh, and it looks like Sadie is having some audio issues. So we can see Sadie's comment, actually, I can read it out, that this is also about getting people to change their behavior. If we consume less, we can make a big difference. Thank you, Sadie. We'll also think about my sense is that these may not be new components, but rather, you know, really weaving these, you know, very good observations into the components that we have.
Yeah, agreed. Well, thanks everyone for your feedback. That was sounds like building out some of these kind of concrete examples. We'll take this back and further refine the working draft of the recommendations document. But at this point, I think we can shift over to the next section. So Vanessa, I'll hand it over to you.
Thanks, Emily. All right. So I think we may get through two more, possibly two and a half more recommendations. We very intentionally wanted to start with workforce development and consumer education today, recognizing their importance and then also recognizing that in some of our panels, discussion, just because of the way the recommendations are kind of sequenced in our document with mitigation strategies coming first and then enabling strategies following, we haven't had as much time. When we've run short on time, on some of the enabling strategies. So we're putting some of those, like, you know, first in our discussion today, recognizing that we've had more time to discuss some of the mitigation strategies. So for innovation, this is another enabling strategy, which I think our panel has recognized is very important, where we've had some good input and thoughts, but a little bit less time to just kind of make sure that we're looking together at all of the components. So the top line recommendation here on innovation is to support research and development demonstration projects, as well as more companies and manufacturers operating in New York State to bring innovative solutions to the marketplace for highly efficient, all electric and resilient buildings, for grid interactive buildings, including revenue opportunities, and for reducing embodied carbon in buildings. So in terms of components, I do want to speak to certain things that, certain components that have been kind of refined and further developed, in order to be responsive to the good input that we're getting from panelists as well as from stakeholders. So first of all, we've had components with respect to innovation in terms of making sure that we're scaling up support to promote tech transfer for innovative building decarbonization technologies and design approaches that are in use outside of the US that could be transferred to the New York State market. And we've had components which are really looking at supporting R&D and demonstrations, and again, tech transfer around next generation HVAC system and highly efficient building envelopes for those high performance buildings. But also, you know, ventilation is included there. And we got a couple of comments just to round out some of the thoughts in that area. And then likewise, we've also had a component that's about grid interactive buildings, or what the DOE refers to as grid interactive efficient buildings, getting kind of technologies, continuing to develop the technologies and the standards in that space. Areas that we've received comments on, and admittedly, we've received comments on this more broadly than R&D, you know, but we have received input on the importance of rate-making strategies and market signals that are going to reward building for, you know, being good grid citizens and provide revenue streams for grid interactive efficient buildings, as well as revenue streams for buildings that can provide thermal storage, thermal services to their neighbors. So we know that there's definitely opportunity to make sure that waste heat isn't just wasted, that heat could be shared, you know, between buildings in many instances. So we've added a component which is really getting at supporting the development of market signals and revenue streams for grid interactive buildings and buildings that are providing these kind of grid services and thermal services, which includes kind of analysis of opportunities, assessment of market mechanisms, and pilots and demonstrations, you know, which would then inform subsequent rulemaking and rate making. So that's an added component. We've also kind of had a note on this one, but just, you know, did write out a component regarding resilience. And again, this is framed as recognizing the need to first assess the needs and then support them. So assess and then support R&D needs with respect to building resilience, recognizing that we are moving towards building electrification, as well as more frequent extreme weather events with climate change. Similarly, kind of resilience and flexibility of the electrical system, and then related energy and thermal storage solutions. So that's a component that has been added in this refinement. And then again, we, similar to a point that Emily made, definitely recognize that minority and women-owned business enterprises and cooperatives, as well as other types of business structure like B Corps, are critical parts of this clean energy economy. So proposing a dedicated kind of call out component to support those types of business entities via dedicated access to expert advisory services, outreach to minority and women-owned business enterprise associations, and then internships, fellowships, and board placement in innovative companies for MWBE entrepreneurs. The fourth thing I want to just note, and I do want to check, I want to check all of these with the panel, but kind of putting a special note on checking, there's an additional recommendation component to assess the opportunity for a dedicated funding stream for demonstrations of new technologies on an ongoing basis. So this is recognizing that, you know, we there are new technologies that are being developed and deployed all the time, and it's, you know, we're not going to kind of find the silver bullet technology. This is about iterative development and technology transfer, and again, you know, kind of design approach approaches, kind of iteratively developing and improving over time. So recognizing that, you know, there'll be an ongoing need for a demonstration project here in New York State to, you know, to accelerate the deployment of these latest technologies and practices. So there have, I'll stop there and just pause to see if anyone has any comments or questions or, you know, suggested refinements in particular to the new components that have been added to the innovation strategy. And Daphne, do you, I see a hand. And then Janet, I see a hand. So Daphne and Janet?
I was gonna say, Janet, do you wanna go first? I know you put your hand up first.
No, go ahead, Daphne. I'll jump in after.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing that information, Vanessa. Just one point, I definitely wanna emphasize that a call out is good, but it's not enough, and ensuring that MWBEs and B Corps and worker cooperatives have an opportunity to actually participate in procurements, such as, you know, the large scale solar and wind projects and electrification initiatives that NYSERDA has is critical, right? We want to kind of not only animate the market, but deploy the market in that space.
Thank you, Daphne.
Vanessa, yeah, a comment and then a question. I think it is worth flagging the very significant federal opportunities to leverage innovation to achieve these goals. You know, in particular for the next 4 years, the innovation space might be one of the, you know, more significant parts of our agenda where we can really strategically use federal funds. So I would suggest a call out for that. And then the comment that you made regarding a dedicated funding stream. So this is more of a question. You know, I would just note that we have a dedicated funding stream through the Clean Energy Fund, which is has allocated about, you know, $60 million a year for innovation in this decarbonization space. So is the suggestion that, you know, that level is not adequate, or, you know, how does that, or there's a different kind of mechanism or model or engagement model that needs to be advanced? So I'm just mindful of the feedback from the council to clarify our recommendations, you know, vis-a-vis what is already in place.
Yep. Thank you, Janet. Yeah. And we do need to add, and this is a direct comment also that we'll take care of, a reference to the amount of money being invested currently. And the sense was that this dedicated funding stream would be useful to scale up the amount of money that's being invested currently, but can certainly kind of test that and talk more to our you, Janet, obviously, and our colleagues on the innovation team who have the access to that clean energy fund funding at NYSERDA, and then also think about, you know, the leveraging of the federal R&D investment, as you're pointing to as well. The one other note, and I, you know, definitely appreciate everybody's feedback on this. I think part of the idea of this dedicated funding stream, or just kind of continued emphasis, whether or not we need additional funding on demos in New York, is really to have those kind of New York-based case studies and comps to really help accelerate the deployment in New York State. And then also recognizing that while we can definitely look to leverage, and in many instances need to leverage federal funding, there's absolutely a very strong opportunity in the innovation space to have the investments have multiplier effects, and if we can build manufacturing capability and kind of solution oriented companies here in New York that are serving the region, then we'll have the economic development impacts as well. So I think they're what's viewed as having the capacity to make state investments, which we do have, but thinking about whether there's good reason to scale those at the state level, in addition to leveraging the federal opportunities, was kind of part of the input as I heard it. Okay, so definitely appreciate that. So we'll take back looking again at kind of the funding availability and what more may be needed. And then to the, thanks Daphne, I see your point about a new joint venture partnership with HPD, and that's it. That's another good point is, you know, thinking about strategic investments, not just state funds, but other entities in New York State, and how do we kind of, what's the role to kind of make the most effective use of the requirements available here. And Sadie, thanks for your input about or possibly thinking about a requirement for MWBE JV partnerships. So good point. So we'll definitely think more about the MWBE aspects across this recommendation and workforce, and then think further about the cost. Otherwise, it seems like, well, I would just like to open it up. Does any other, I guess it's any concerns about, you know, some of the newer things that we put on the table, or any other refinements that people would like to suggest? And then the next point that I wanted to make is, right now, reducing embodied carbon in buildings is part of this innovation enabling strategy. The panel, a subgroup of the panel had, I think, a very, very interesting and insightful discussion of embodied carbon last week, and recognized that there's a lot of opportunity for state-funded projects to lead by example, and that really does go beyond, you know, R&D and demonstrations in terms of leading by example in state-funded projects vis-a-vis embodied carbon, emphasizing, you know, training and familiarity in terms of architects and engineers to use embodied carbon calculators in this space, and then also having more data and more, you know, environmental product declarations, more of a sense of what the embodied carbon budgets are for buildings. So kind of similarly to how we're thinking about benchmarking energy usage as an important piece of the puzzle, having the data to then think about building energy standards. Similarly, you know, having data on embodied carbon in building construction projects, and then thinking about what embodied carbon budgets could look like going forward. So our recommendation, or a recommendation I want to put on the table, is to actually build out embodied carbon as its own enabling strategy, rather than have it nested here under innovation. So it would become, you know, its own strategy with, like, essentially the three slides that that show up. And so similarly, the staff team is working to build out a recommendation on HFCs and refrigerants. So similarly, building out from what's been discussed so far, a recommendation on embodied carbon. So does that resonate with folks, or does anyone have any kind of counterpoints on that one? Okay. Well, we will work on that as a staff team and bring that. And thanks, Sadie, for your note saying it makes sense. Okay. So we are. We didn't get through as much as we'd hoped to today, but again, did want to do this in a thoughtful manner to make sure we're not kind of rushing to the end. I do want to quickly hit benchmarking, and I'll do this in just 2 minutes. So what I wanted to share about benchmarking, and, you know, please do take a look at the comments that have come in and have been circulated. But there was a set of questions and comments around benchmarking, asking whether there'd be any consequences or penalties for underperformance, or any requirements for buildings that are undertaking required building energy assessments to actually make upgrades. So my thinking on this set of recommendations is it's really focused on making sure the information is available to building owners and decision makers, and to market participants who are thinking about, you know, purchasing or renting a building. So I do not believe that this set of recommendations is involves penalties for underperformance, nor would it necessarily require upgrades. You know, any kind of requirements would become a building performance standard, which is actually covered under the codes and standards portion of the recommendations. So, yeah, as currently drafted, requiring building energy usage, benchmarking energy performance, and making that information accessible via disclosure or labeling really is about getting the information into the hands of the market actors. And then any kind of subsequent requirements for building upgrades are coming through in the codes and standards recommendations. So with that lens, I think we do need to wrap up the meeting today, but I would ask you all to kind of think about that lens, vis-a-vis the benchmarking and disclosure mitigation strategy. And, you know, please continue to provide feedback if the way that strategy is being communicated raises any questions or concerns. Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Melina to look at next steps.
All right. Thanks, Vanessa. Can everyone hear me? All right,
yes.
Can we go to the next slide? Oh, thank you. We'll fly through this. So next steps. First off, we have quite a few subgroups meeting planned for the second half of March. It's already March 16th. We've survived the Ides of March. Congratulations to us. So March 17th, which is tomorrow, we have a subgroup meeting planned regarding considerations for affordable and rent-regulated housing. Next week, on the 24th, we're planning with Sadie and Brett as hosts. Thank you to Sadie and Brett. To create a financing and possible financial solutions level setting meeting, sort of informational. We might have some guest speakers joining us for that, so stay tuned. Following that, March 31st, if all goes to plan, we're hoping to reconvene following that financial solutions meeting to have a deeper discussion on creative solutions and sort of a working group to see what sort of like creative capital solutions we can come up with to address some of these recommendations. And to be confirmed in March, we're possibly going to be planning time or maybe squeeze into one of these meetings to discuss and provide feedback on input assumptions for the integration analysis and also our panel's cause and impact scenarios. So this is all leading up to April, which is also a very, very busy month, 2 weeks from now. On April 12th is the Climate Action Council meeting, where the members are going to be reviewing recommendations from a few other panels, ag and forestry, waste, energy intensive and trade exposed industries, and just transition. So please tune in for that. That's going to be really interesting. This is out of order, I just realized. Apologies, everyone. On April 9th, so 3 days before that, we're hoping to have a pen down on our recommendations for this panel. On April 16th, the recommendations for this panel and for the remaining panels are going to be shared with panel chairs for review. And then from that point forward, the panels and the panel members are going to be shifting to meeting on as-needed basis to reconvene for further potential collaboration and refinement as we see fit collaboratively. On to the big event in May, everyone, May 3rd. Our recommendations are going to be shared with the Climate Action Council in time for the May 10th Climate Action Council meeting, where all these recommendations will be reviewed during the May 10th meeting. So it'd be our panel, land use and local government, power gen, and transportation. So those are the big events coming up. We've accomplished a lot. We're almost there. Thank you to everyone. I see we're 1 minute over. If anybody has any questions about the timeline, please reach out to us. We will address. Thank you. Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thanks for the continued hard work.
Thank you.
Thank you.